This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there, it's the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West here on RN and the ABC Listen app. The COVID-19 pandemic licensed governments around the world to exercise unprecedented levels of control over their citizens. The debate will continue for years, even decades, as to how useful or damaging the lockdowns were. In China, where we'll take you soon, there are still punitive lockdowns. Faith communities were among the most affected by restrictions. And now the independent Pew Research Center in Washington has released the findings of a major study into government control over religion. Pew studied data from 198 countries. The lead researcher is Samira Majumdar.
In 2020, when the COVID-19 pandemic took hold globally, many countries banned or limited public gatherings to slow its spread. In our latest report that tracks restrictions on religion around the world, we focus on how lockdowns and other public health measures affected religious groups and how they responded. And among some of the key findings include the fact that authorities in nearly a quarter of all countries that we studied used physical means, such as arrests and prison sentences, to enforce coronavirus-related restrictions on worship services and other religious gatherings. Detentions were the most common type of force that authorities used against religious groups when they were deemed in violation of public health guidelines. But authorities also raided places of worship and physically attacked people who gathered for religious services as well.
Yes, I believe that in some cases you found there were people who were killed in enforcing restrictions against religious practice during COVID.
That is correct. We found that in three countries, actually, authorities had killed people who were in violation of public health guidelines. For example, in India, we found reports that two Christians had died after they were beaten in police custody for violating COVID-19 curfews in the southern state of Tamil Nadu.
And the main grievance of religious groups that found themselves restricted due to COVID was what?
Religious groups filed lawsuits or spoke out against public health measures in about 27% of the countries that we studied. A common complaint was that some churches, mosques, synagogues, and other houses of worship were treated unequally, either by comparison with secular gathering places like shops and restaurants, or by comparison with other religious groups.
Now, I believe Australia actually also gets a mention in this report. In what context?
So in Australia, we also measured the number of countries where religious groups defied public health rules. So in each of the regions that we studied, at least 3 in 10 countries had such reports about religious groups. In Australia, we picked up incidents in March 2020 when groups of ultra-Orthodox Jews met for prayer in a private courtyard in Melbourne in violation of a national ban on gatherings at places of worship. And this was also against a similar directive by local Jewish leaders. But Australia wasn't the only place where these types of defiances of public health rules occurred. In the United States, we reported incident of a pastor in the state of Louisiana holding services at his church in April 2020 in defiance of stay-at-home orders by the government. And he told hundreds of attendees that they had, quote, nothing to fear but fear itself.
We should mention that many religious groups and religious leaders obeyed the COVID restrictions. In fact, weren't some religious groups and leaders co-opted to spread anti-COVID messages?
In our study, we actually saw that a large share of countries had religious groups or leaders actually promoting public health measures to slow the spread of the coronavirus by encouraging followers to worship at home, observe social distancing, or take other precautions such as hand washing and mask wearing. We saw this in about half of the countries we analyzed. We also saw cases where government officials and religious groups collaborated on efforts to stem the pandemic. In some countries, religious leaders could have both defied and promoted lockdowns or other public health restrictions.
And were there any places where COVID-19 restrictions were effectively used to disband entire religious groups? I did see some reference to that.
Yes. In the case of some instances where the government used force to disband religious worship services, we saw governments also raiding churches to disband groups themselves. In South Korea, authorities raided the headquarters of the Shincheonji Church of Jesus, largely because it violated restrictions on public gatherings, and its leaders refused to share membership lists with authorities so they could track the spread of the virus.
I'm also fascinated by the situation in Pakistan, where Shia Muslims of Hazara background seem to be targeted. What happened there?
Authorities and social groups both in several countries blamed religious groups for spreading the virus. We saw authorities linking religious groups in 18 countries in our study to the spread of the virus. And Pakistan was one of these countries. Shia Muslims of Hazara ethnicity had returned from a pilgrimage to Iran in 2020, and they were targeted and scapegoated for spreading the virus by officials in the country's Balochistan province. Social media users in the country also blamed Shias for spreading the virus and used derogatory statements like describing COVID-19 as the Shia virus on social media.
And just finally, Samira, what methods did religious organizations that were trying to push back against COVID restrictions use? I mean, was it outright defiance or did they find other ways?
In 35% of the countries that we studied, one or more religious groups defied public health rules related to the COVID-19 pandemic. We also saw religious groups filing lawsuits or speaking out against public health measures in 27% of countries that we analyzed. In the United States, for example, lawsuits over state and municipal health restrictions were filed by numerous religious groups, including the Roman Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn and several synagogues and rabbis in New York. And they contended that pandemic-related restrictions violated the guarantee of free exercise of religion that is contained in the country's First Amendment of the Constitution.
Samira Majumdar of the Pew Research Centre, and you're on the Religion and Ethics Report on air or the ABC Listen app. You've probably seen the protests roiling China, tens of thousands in the streets and on the campuses, angry that almost 3 years on from the outbreak of COVID, the regime is still locking people up. A fire in a block of flats killed 10 people, unable to flee because of restrictions. But the protests carry a bigger human rights message for leader Xi Jinping, freedom and democracy for his communist state. China scholar Dr. Tao Zhang is at Nottingham Trent University in the UK. She wrote about the uprising for The Conversation.
I think the most innovative expression of protests is many protesters reading blank sheets of A4 paper. That's why the protest is dubbed as the A4 revolution or blank paper revolution.
What does the blank sheet of paper actually mean, though?
China's censorship has been widely known to the world. The level of information control has been intensified in recent years. So it's very risky for individuals or groups of people to publicly criticize the government and protest in public places. It's very, very risky. That's why these protests, you could say, has taken the world by surprise. The blank sheet of A4 paper is open to interpretation. Some people say it represents people's grief, sadness, anger, discontent, public criticism of censorship. And that's the interesting aspect of A4 revolution, because the blank paper on the surface says nothing. But in fact, it contains, you could say, many meanings, many ideas people were not able to express.
And who's leading these protests? Because it's a risky thing to lead a protest in China. So who's leading them?
From the media reports and social media, I can see three constituencies of protesters. First were migrant workers, for example, in Foxconn factory, the biggest iPhone factory in the world, there were clashes between workers and police. Also in Guangzhou, there were some clashes between migrant workers and riot police. The second is local residents. It was clear in the protests in Urumqi, in Xinjiang, following the fire on 24th, there was local protests on 25th. And that was very much led by local residents, was a spontaneous demonstration in front of the government building. But the third group, there were protests in Shanghai, Beijing, Chengdu, and some other big cities. The main groups were the young professionals and university students.
We know that the protests started because of China's very harsh COVID lockdown policies. The rest of the world is opening up, has opened up. China is still pursuing a zero COVID. And of course, you mentioned a fire in which 10 people died because everyone was confined to their homes because of COVID. But there's more to the protests than COVID, isn't there?
Definitely. I think that is why the protests have been referred to the biggest since the 1989 Tiananmen movement. I think that really can be understood in three terms. The first one is the scale. I don't mean the absolute number of protesters. Of course, compared to 1989, the protest number this time were much smaller. What I meant is about protests being countrywide. And the protests broke out in multiple locations across the country, not only in multiple cities, but also on a big number of university campuses across the country. Yeah. And that scale of protests hasn't been seen since 1989. And second is about the spontaneity. As we know, China has numerous protests, well, since 1989. This 1989 stood out because it has a sort of countrywide common grievance.
Yeah. But these protests, they're very audacious because you've got a paramount leader in Xi Jinping who has effectively declared himself leader for life. You've got these protesters, aren't they saying an end to the regime? This is not small reform, it's an end to the regime, aren't they asking for?
That particular demand has been shouted, at least in a protest in Shanghai. That's very much unheard in protests across the country since 1989. That's another point I like to say, because the demands expressed not only is against the government's zero COVID policy, but also demanding freedom of speech, rule of law, and democracy. And even some went as far as demanding the regime change. That means it is significant.
We know how the Chinese regime reacted to Tiananmen Square. Mm-hmm. And that was with a notorious massacre. We know that. They still haven't ever acknowledged just how many thousands of people may have been killed in that massacre. Is the Chinese regime, is Xi Jinping's regime likely to make any concessions to these widespread protests?
What we can see from the media reports, the government has eased COVID control measures in some cities so far. But of course, we don't know how far these easing measures will go. And also the government did not acknowledge it was response to the protests, rather his government's own initiative to decide to open up the society. But in fact, we can see it is the pressure of public protests obviously led to the easing up. And of course, on the other hand, we can see immediately the government has doubled down on censorship and also arrested some protesters. That has been very much predicted by many activists, there is very little sign we can say the government is relaxing its control on public criticism and dissent.
Dr. Tao Zhang of Nottingham Trent University. Monarchists have marked their calendars the 6th of May next year when Charles III is crowned. He became king automatically after his mother Queen Elizabeth died in September, but the coronation is the big event, a pageant and a deeply religious ceremony. Charles wants a shorter, more modern service at Westminster Abbey, but its Christian elements will remain, and in a Britain and Commonwealth increasingly not Christian, that's controversial. Catherine Pepinster is author of Defenders of the Faith, The British Monarchy, Religion and the Next Coronation, released this week in Australia.
There has been debate in the UK about to what extent this coronation should be a religious ceremony, a religious service, because the number of people who belong to the Church of England and even belong to Christian churches is declining. But as I understand it, there's no question that it is going to be a religious service again.
And what will the key religious elements actually look like?
The framework of the coronation service is a communion service. There are three key parts within that communion service. There's the anointing of the monarch, the oath taking, that's not quite so religious, it's more legal, but it's about religion, and the crowning, and the monarch is crowned by the Archbishop of Canterbury. So those are the key components, if you like, surrounded by prayers, surrounded by readings, and surrounded by religious music. So it adds up to a pretty religious ceremony. There has been some discussion about whether there might be a more secular ceremony afterwards.
You've raised this question of whether it could be what you call a melting pot coronation. What would a melting pot coronation look like?
I think it's entirely possible that it won't be quite so Anglican as before. Of course, you know, we haven't had a coronation for 70 years. Britain has changed very much. The Commonwealth changed in that time too. So there have been debates about how it might change. So I think that there are very likely to be the involvement of different Christian denominations. I can imagine that leading figures from other Christian denominations might give readings and say prayers. And I think there'll also be the involvement of other faiths. I think it's entirely likely there will be a procession that would involve Muslim representatives, Jewish representatives. So we have many Hindus, Sikhs, etc. in the UK, and of course from the Commonwealth too. So I think they'll be involved. As to whether they might say a prayer, I'm not entirely sure if that's going to happen, but I think it's quite possible.
Yes, I mean, if we look at the various remembrance services and indeed the funeral for the late Queen, they were obviously very Anglican, but all the other major Christian denominations, notably the Catholics, were involved. And as you say, the leaders of the Islamic, Jewish, Hindu, Jain, Sikh faiths, they had their moment in the sun, as it were. I think they often greeted the new king at the door of the church.
Yes. The thing that is worth remembering is that Westminster Abbey has form in involving other faiths, because a significant event, annual event that's held at Westminster Abbey is the Commonwealth Day service every year that the royal family attend. And that for many, many years has had the involvement of representatives of other faiths. So they know how to do it. And the other thing that happened was between the death of Elizabeth II and her funeral, there were several church services around Britain in the capitals of the devolved nations. Those are Edinburgh, Cardiff and Belfast. And they had the involvement of other denominations. And the one in Cardiff, a Muslim said one of the prayers as well. So they know how to do it.
There's another very interesting model that you cite, Before he became king, Charles attended the coronation of the new Emperor of Japan. Now, what did he learn from that event?
Well, he learned from that event that you can have more than one ceremony that makes up a coronation. And so they had a deeply religious service in Japan, and then they had another that was more secular. And I think that the new king, who had advisors who also travelled to Japan for that event, I think he may well be thinking the Japanese, who manage something full of tradition, also manage something very modern. And I think that's what they're going to try and do. They're going to try and combine the traditional with the contemporary. And the thing that to me is so interesting is that there weren't many other examples that they could look at, because in Europe, where there are still several other countries with monarchs, they don't have coronations. So Britain stands alone in that in Europe. So Japan really was their go-to place to find out how these things can be done in the modern age.
Mm. There is a very sacred, but it's also very secretive part of a coronation ceremony. We haven't seen it for, what, 71 years? And we didn't really even see it 71 years ago when the late Queen was crowned. What happens during the anointing?
The anointing, according to people I've spoken to who are religious experts, say that's the most essential religious service, much more important than the coronation. This is the moment when the monarch is blessed. It's very much like a sacrament. It's akin to priestly ordination in many ways. God's grace is bestowed on the person, and God's grace will help them in their service over the years. And they're anointed, as often happens in sacraments such as baptism and confirmation, with holy oils. When this last happened with Queen Elizabeth II, she was hidden by a canopy from both the congregation inside Westminster Abbey and also from the television cameras. That was the first coronation shown live on television. But that moment was viewed as so sacred and so precious and so intimate that it wasn't shown.
Yes, isn't part of the new monarch's breast exposed and a cross is made on it by the Archbishop of Canterbury? That's why it's so secretive?
Yes, the head is also anointed with oil and the breast too. Yes, a sign of the cross made. It is an intimate, very holy moment. And Elizabeth II was stripped of some of her very rich coronation robes, and then she was just in a white shift for that moment. So very simple gown, rather like babies are dressed in white or adults in white when they're baptized. You know, she was in white. It was almost a form of initiation, and it suggests a kind of purity about it. I personally don't think that the king is going to be suddenly removing what is probably going to be military uniform and be suddenly in a kind of white tunic. I think that's unlikely. When it's a queen who's being anointed and crowned, there's something a bit more sacrificial about it, to a slightly disturbing extent, I think. And I just don't think it will have that kind of characteristic with an elderly man.
Well, you point out in the book, fascinating book, that it almost has elements of a kind of virgin sacrifice, this young woman being sacrificed to her nation, to her realm, I suppose. You also have this rather interesting observation, Charles as pontifex, pontifex being bridge builder. I thought pontifex, interestingly, was the old name for a pope.
That's why I deliberately used it, but I think that in many ways is what he's trying to do. And we've seen that in these very early weeks of his reign. And I'm sure that he's going to want his coronation to reflect those beliefs and those interests that he has. Mm. The thing that is an issue, and I'm not quite sure how they're going to square this particular circle, is that people in Britain, large numbers of them, don't have any faith at all. And he's also going to need to kind of bring them into the tent too.
Well, one way he may do this, and I'm sure there's a religious impetus for this, and that is through something called a welfare monarchy. What is a welfare monarchy, and does it have some sort of religious impetus behind it?
It certainly has certain ideals. This is an idea that a political theorist came up with, the welfare monarchy, because over the recent years, during the reign, particularly of Elizabeth II, but a little bit perhaps with her father too, what we've seen in Britain is a monarchy that has become very strongly linked to good works, to philanthropy, through patronage of charities, and then also linking itself in some ways to our welfare state, opening hospitals, visiting many of our state schools. It's endorsed the idea that we should all be involved in service of others and provision for those in need. And I think that's something which this monarch will want to continue.
Now, finally, Catherine, Walter Badgett, the great British writer and constitutional scholar, when he was asked about the monarchy, you know, being the head of the church or the head of state, I think he said, no, the monarchy is the head of our morality. I mean, is that still a viable notion in a country that's frankly, in a world that's frankly pretty permissive today, you know, to have someone presented as the head of our morality?
I think that saying head of our morality sounds very odd to 21st century ears. I think a different way of saying it might be embodies our country's values. I think that's the kind of thing that King Charles would say. And that would be why he would say that he has this duty to protect the space for faith, that that is what Britain should be about in the modern age. But to say head of morality does sound slightly odd, because I think for most people, morality means personal behaviour. And I don't think people like the idea of anybody telling them what their personal behaviour should be. And I think there are still plenty of people who would say of the royal family, well, given how some of them have behaved, I don't think they should be held up as exemplars of how we should behave. And of course, one of the things that keeps happening is that every time they think life is for them is calming down a bit, another series of The Crown appears on Netflix.
It is fiction.
Yeah, while if you watch it and you know anything about these things, you know that quite a bit of it is not true. Quite a bit of it is true. And so, you know, they combine fact and fiction, and then it seems to be quite convincing as being the story of the royals. And that reinforces the idea that they shouldn't tell us what to do.
Well, it's very good to speak with you, as always. Catherine Pepinster, she's the former editor of The Tablet, one of the world's leading magazines of faith. Catherine's new book is Defenders of the Faith, The British Monarchy, Religion and the Next Coronation, and it is just released in Australia. Catherine, thank you for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you, Andrew.
And there's a longer version of that discussion at our homepage or when you download the ABC Listen app and search for the program there. That's it for today. Thanks to Hong Zhang and Roy Huberman. I'm Andrew West, and join us again for the Religion and Ethics Report.
Conversations.
Spend an hour in the life of someone else.
World's longest horse race, the Mongol Derby. The Australians, especially the bushies, tend to do really well on this race.
Someone who has seen and done remarkable things.
Hit that rabbit hole and I got javelin head first in the ground. How did I not fracture one of my cervical vertebrae? I have no idea. It's a Mongolian herdosaurus, formed a cavalry charge, and we charged towards the finish line.
Conversations with Richard Feidler and Sarah Konoski.
Weekdays at 3 p.m. on RN or anytime on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.